It's another day of highs in the triple digits for much of the state. We see a little bit of relief in the forecast, but not a lot of rain. How is your garden coping with conditions? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Richard Giron and Ajay Nair of Iowa State University Extension will be here. We'll talk about how to care for your plants in these extreme conditions. We'll also talk about how to get the most out of your vegetable garden, no matter what conditions are like, and how you can use tunnel gardening techniques at home to extend the season. We'll also be answering your questions about your yard or garden. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me is horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. Hello, Ajay.
Hi. Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And it has been hot. That's no secret. Incredibly hot the last couple of weeks. Richard, how does that affect the home garden?
Well, as far as a home garden, if you have things like tomatoes and peppers, they may bloom, but those flowers may not develop into fruit. Because when you have extremely hot temperatures, that interferes with pollination, and you don't get very good fruit sets. So there may be a period here where the flowers just simply dry up and fall off. It could also affect the pollination on sweet corn. When you have extremely high temperatures, that also affects pollination. So later on, when you harvest the ears, you may find quite a few missing kernels in the actual ear. So that could affect the quality.
Well, and we experienced this at almost the exact same time last summer, too, didn't we?
Yeah, basically. It's, I think, worse this year. I mean, it's been hotter for a longer period of time, and it's also dry. So you have the high temperatures and the dry conditions, and that really does stress the plants. And so they're under heat stress, drought stress. We can water to relieve the drought stress. And so if you wish, you can go ahead and water. And if you do that, water well about once a week should be fine for most garden situations as far as fruits and vegetables.
And Charity, you are pretty correct. Last year, too, we had issues. Like I got samples of snap beans where growers had sent samples talking about blossom drop, in which there are blossoms on snap beans, but they don't end up into pod. And the primary reason was the heat. Above a certain temperature, 90 degree Fahrenheit, the blossoms drop. And that's also associated with the moisture content because the snap beans, if they don't have enough moisture, that also aggravates the issue of blossom drop. So what Richard mentioned, you know, the heat and in combination with less irrigation or less water can aggravate the issue.
If with the heat we're having pollination problems, does the water issue even matter to plants like tomatoes and sweet corn?
Well, I would still make sure they have water so that they can keep on growing and produce additional flowers in the weeks to come. And it may already have fruit on the plant, so you want to make sure that fruit has plenty of moisture. So definitely go ahead and water if you can. There may be a period when they don't set fruit, but they'll keep on growing and still flowering and potentially still produce a good crop.
Okay, so we'll have a couple of weeks perhaps where we don't have fruit, but it should at that point pick up again.
If the weather moderates.
Right. That seems to be a big if right now. Okay, we have covered watering guidelines before, but let's hit on it again. In a condition like this where we just really aren't getting any rain, how often do you water and how much moisture do the plants need when you do water?
Most plants would like about an inch, maybe an inch and a half per week. That would be ideal for most fruits, vegetables, annual flowers. If you do water, the key there is to water well, water deeply when you do so. And if you do that, the water should soak down several inches, 6, 7, 8 inches, maybe deeper. And then it's going to take several days for that water to basically evaporate or being used up by the plants. So if it's done well, most plants should be fine for about a week or so.
And the way water is associated with the plant is the nutrient uptake. So you might have seen homeowners and even commercial growers talking about their tomatoes turning black at the end, like concentric black rings at the end. That actually is caused by calcium deficiency. So your soil might have the enough calcium what the plant needs, but if there is no water, that calcium is not being taken up by the plant. So just having calcium in the soil doesn't help. There has to be enough water, and the water frequency has to be uniform. You cannot water a lot on one day, and then you come back after 7 days and again water. It has to be constant and uniform, and that will help as Richard mentioned, for the fruits to set and also the fruits to be free of any defects or diseases.
Okay.
Now, if you have something in a container, like a tomato or a pepper plant or flowers, you probably should check those every day. And when you do water, water thoroughly. You want to keep on adding water until water flows out the bottom of the pot. That gives you a good clue that you've moistened the entire soil ball. And in some cases, you may have to water every single day during those hot, dry periods. Others maybe not as often, but some plants really demand moisture on a constant basis, like impatiens, fuchsias, things like that.
And we've talked about this before as well, but your preference, Richard, I know, is to water close to the ground, close to the roots of the plant, as opposed to putting in a sprinkler or using a hose to spray the plants.
Right. You can water by various means. You can use a soaker hose, drip irrigation, a sprinkler, a water wand. So you can water by various means. The key there is to water well. And if you do use a sprinkler, if you do use a water wand, morning would be the ideal time to do it, like 6 or 8 in the morning. When the temperature is fairly mild, we have no strong winds, and the water can soak into the ground. You lose very little through evaporation, and that's the ideal time. For most people, late afternoon, evening is the most practical time. But as far as if you do it then and you get the foliage wet, the biggest concern there is you may have greater disease problems because the plants stay wet all evening long. So,
Ajay, what's your favorite system for watering?
I think I'll go what Richard mentioned. You know, usually I water close to the plant in bigger operations, or if homeowners who have a bigger yard, they can even think about drip irrigation. That way they can conserve moisture. They do not put a lot of water, and they can provide the water uniformly. And that helps with the nutrient uptake, with the overall plant growth.
All right. Ajay, I know that you spend most of your time at the Horticulture Research Station. What do you focus your research on?
At the Horticulture Research Station, we have a wide gamut of research projects going on there. My research focus is on sustainable vegetable production. So how to grow vegetables in a sustainable manner, more efficient manner with less amount of inputs. And I focus on different areas. The first one is transplant production that starts from the greenhouse. How can you produce healthy, robust, and strong transplants? Because if you have a strong transplant to begin with, your crop will be better in the field. And then we move on to the field, look into other aspects of how to improve the soil. We use cover crops to build up the soil organic matter, bring the nutrients back, improve the water holding capacity. That way we are directly affecting the plant growth. Every now and then, we also look at some practical aspects. You know, these strategies are long-term. It takes time for the soil to change, for the crops to show the response. But we look at other strategies like season extension. Here in Iowa, Charity, you might know that there is a big impetus and a push on local food production. There are a lot of people who want to get in, produce, might have acreages. They grow their own vegetables. And in Iowa, the difficult situation is how to prolong the season. Of course, this year we didn't have any issue prolonging the season. But the winter, you know, starts early, it gets colder. So what are the strategies we can use? So use of high tunnels, row covers, plastic mulches to heat the soil up. That's another area of research.
And you've been doing research on what you're calling low tunnel, so a smaller version of the high tunnel. Is that something that people can actually use in their home garden?
I think so. It is pretty effective, not only in terms of increasing or expanding the growing season, extending the season, but also it can be used as a insect management strategy, because once you have the row cover on the plants, it acts as a mechanical barrier between the insect and the plant. So there you go. So maybe no Japanese beetle. Let's cross our fingers for that. And let's say cucumber. So cucumber beetles are a major problem. They can be kept away using the row covers. And the other side of using row cover is that you can enhance the temperature around the plant. So that way the plants grow faster, even if the temperature is low outside. But inside the row covers, the temperature would be most of the time 5 to 7 degrees higher than the outside. So that helps plant growth.
It seems like in this kind of weather, though, that wouldn't help very much.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to cook your plants underneath as well. But there are different type of row covers, Charity, depending upon your usage. So let's say your objective is to increase the temperature. Then you get row covers which are thicker and they insulate well, so the heat traps inside. But there are certain ones which are more transparent, so they transmit more light. So in that case, you can use that as an insect barrier rather than increasing the temperature. So depending upon what your users, you have different products available in the market.
Okay, so it's something that you could install and not have to try to tear down for the hot summer months. That you can actually use it as a management tool.
Yeah, what we usually recommend or suggest is we install them very early in the spring if we want to extend the season in the spring. Just use regular GI wires. The regular wire, we cut it about 3 or 4 feet long strips. We bend them, put it over the plant, and then we every 4 feet, we'll put these wires and then roll the row cover on top of it. And one thing which is very critical and important in Iowa is that you need to secure the row cover properly, because the wind, it can just, you know, rip it off in seconds.
Sure.
So make sure we install it well, secure it well. And then in cucurbits, you don't want to put the row cover for a long time, because cucurbit needs pollinators. You need to have those honeybees and bumblebees to come and pollinate. So you would keep the row cover for, let's say, 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then you take it off. And you roll it back, put it in, maybe use it the next fall for some other crop, maybe lettuce or spinach. So it can, you can use it multiple times.
And you have a field day coming up at the research station, right?
That's right. That is on the 23rd of July, and that's at the Horticulture Research Station here on campus in Ames. It's north of 69 near Gilbert. Field day is actually organized by the Department of Horticulture in partnership with the Iowa Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association and the Leopold Center for Sustainable Ag. And what we want to do is there are multiple researchers focusing on different aspects. So we want to showcase that to our growers, commercial growers, homeowners, master gardeners. I think it will be a wonderful opportunity to learn and new things and techniques.
All right. And that's coming up on July 23rd, the Fruit and Vegetable Field Day at the Horticulture Research Station. We put up a link to that on our Facebook page so you can find out more about it. We're going to take a quick break, but then we're going to come back and answer your questions. Join us at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send us an email. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me today, horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension and Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialists. They are here today to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start with an email question from Ryan. He says, 2 years ago, I planted a rose tree. I took special care to buy a rose tree that could survive in our hardiness zone after the previous one froze during the winter. The first summer we had the tree, it bloomed the entire summer with pink flowers. Last summer it didn't bloom at all, but we got all kinds of green growth. I did a soil sample through ISU Extension, and the results were that the soil was very high in potassium and phosphorus. I was to add only nitrogen. As such, I didn't fertilize it the rest of the summer. This spring, the tree bloomed purple flowers, not pink, and bloomed for about a month. We deadheaded the tree and took some of the flowers for indoor arrangements. Since we did that, we have not gotten a single bloom. Listening to your show, I know that rose bushes like water about an inch a week and fertilizer. Having tried every combination I can think of, I'm at a loss.
Well, the rose tree is not very well adapted to Iowa. You have this standard tree that's grafted way up on the actual stem. And my guess is what happened is that everything above the graft union or bud union has died, and now the growth is coming from the rootstock. That's why we have this color change. So we've lost the original plant, everything above the graft union or bud union, and now we're getting growth from basically just the rootstock plant. So that's basically what they're going to have. And it sounds like it must be some type of old-fashioned shrub rose that blooms basically just once in maybe late spring or so. And so they're kind of stuck with that. There's nothing they can do to change.
Okay. So it's not a not something he can fix at this point.
No. It's still a rose, but it's the rootstock rose and not the initial plant.
Okay. And given that you said it's not well adapted to our environment, is this something that you recommend against planting?
Yeah, tree roses just aren't very suitable for Iowa. Oftentimes we do suffer serious winter damage, and that may actually destroy the plant. If you have one, probably the best way to do that is to actually have it in a pot. And then bring that pot maybe inside in a cool garage and overwinter that plant in that garage, or maybe a shed where it's still cold but not extremely cold. It can stay there all winter and then move outside again in the spring. But if you leave it outside, it's exposed to those cold temperatures, maybe 15 below, 20 below, and it may destroy the plant.
All right, so you might want to pick another kind of rose.
Right.
Sorry, Ryan, not good news there, but at least he has a living rose tree at the moment.
Right.
All right. And this is another email, Ralph from Cedar Rapids. He says, I understand how water, rain, is measured. What do you mean by an inch of water if I'm watering my garden? How do I measure that?
Well, if you are using a sprinkler, what you can do is actually buy two or three inexpensive rain gauges and put those in the water pattern, and then run the irrigation system for maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then measure the amount of water in those, take the average, and that will give you some idea how much water you put on. If you're using, like, let's say, a water wand, in that case, you're not going to measure the actual moisture. The best way to check on that is to go out, maybe, let's say, water the area for maybe 20, 30 minutes, let it soak in, and then go out with maybe a screwdriver or a soil auger and put that in the ground and see how far deep you've gone. If you moisten just the upper 2 or 3 inches, you haven't watered enough. Keep on watering. If you find moisture down maybe 7, 8 inches, you've done a good job.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones now. Todd is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Todd.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
Well, my wife and I are planting a garden this year. It's the first time we've ever done this. We don't know what we're doing. We did a raised bed garden about 4 by 8 feet. We have 8 tomato plants, and remember, we don't know what we're doing here. We planted 8 of the tomato plants on one end of the garden in about 2 to 3 square feet of space, so they're way too close together. However, we've been watering them every day. We got a rain barrel. We haven't had to use much of our own water, so they're not lacking for water. And they're going nuts. They're about 7 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a big wall, a big tomato bush now. And so far, it's all healthy, and there's lots of fruit on there. But I wonder what's going to happen to the fruit in the center of this big bush, and you know, et cetera. Am I going to have problems in the coming weeks?
Well, the biggest problem may be finding them, locating them, because the actual fruit do not need light to ripen. They will ripen on their own, so they don't need light, but they're going to be hard to find, I think.
So that's going to be your. My wife's afraid of spiders, but I have no problem going in there and finding the fruit.
Okay. It takes about 45, 50 days for a standard tomato for that fruit to grow and eventually ripen. So it takes about a month and a half for them to do that. So start looking at that point. Definitely do not fertilize at this point if you have been.
No, we haven't done anything at all to them except for water.
Yeah, so keep on watering them. Now, we normally suggest a spacing more like maybe 2.5 to 3 feet apart.
Yeah, that's what I found out belatedly. So, and I was going to pull some out, but I think it was too late. Now it's afraid of if I uprooted some of the plants, I might affect the other ones. So we just kind of let it go and said we'd see what happened, you know?
So I think you're forcing them to grow tall. They can't go outwards, so they may get to be like, oh, maybe 8-9 feet tall eventually.
I
maybe
had no
taller.
Idea that tomatoes got so big. Like we put a big fence thing on two posts next to them to support them, and it's starting, the weight of them is starting to even pull that over.
Right. Something to keep in mind next year, there are determinate varieties which are much smaller in size. They maybe get 2.5-3 feet tall. And then you have the indeterminate varieties that keep on growing until they're destroyed by a frost or freeze in the fall. And so those, the way they're going, might get to be 8-10 feet tall.
And I think
excellent. Well, that's good news then, generally.
Todd, I think you might be using the indeterminate variety. That's why, you know, they are just going crazy. And the other thing to consider is if you are planting so close or close by, is that you might have more fungal disease problems because there is less aeration between the plants and between the rows.
Right.
There's one disease called the leaf mold. So if you flip the leaf over, you see black circles. That's a very common issue which we see when there is no air circulation. So the space
that would be on the leaves on the inside, not on the outside.
Usually when you get the leaf mold, you get it from the bottom up. You will see, but yeah, the areas where there is no aeration, you see them more often there.
Okay, that's great information. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks a lot for your call, Todd. And at this point, would you actually recommend that he take out a couple of the plants to give him some more space, or do you just go with what you have at this point?
I would go with it.
Me too.
See what happens.
Right. Let's go. I think it would be heartbreaking to have to pull him out. Mary's on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Okay, every morning when I go out to my flower garden, I find these beetles that are black, blue, green, especially on the roses. They just dig their heads in and they eat up the rose petals. Mm-hmm. I've tried spraying them with 8 and I've picked them off. What else can I do? They just keep coming.
Well, they're probably Japanese beetles.
Okay.
And the Japanese beetles are very numerous right now. And they feed on over 300 different plants, but they have their favorites. And roses are one of their favorites. They love raspberries, grapevines, linden trees, birch trees, pussy willows. So they definitely have their favorites. They're typically present for like 4 to 6 weeks. So it's a pretty long time frame. They're very, very hard to control. They are. It's very difficult. In the case of roses, you can spray with insecticides like 7 or 8, but you're going to have to do it frequently for several weeks. The thing with the Japanese beetles is that they emerge at different times over several weeks. So you can go out there and spray and kill what's there, but then more emerge from the ground, and then they start feeding on plants, then you spray again. So it tends to be kind of a vicious circle. They're just very, very hard to control, but you can use like 7 or 8. Now, some people that are dedicated rosarians might build like a frame, like a wooden frame or a metal frame around their rose plants, and then they might drape a very fine mesh netting over that frame and then pin that to the ground and physically prevent the actual Japanese beetle from reaching the plants. And you could do that for high-value plants. Otherwise, you spray and hope for the best.
All right. Good luck with that, Mary. Thanks a lot for your call. Another Mary on the line now from Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two questions about shrubs, if that's okay.
Sure.
The first is a summer sweet clethra that I planted in 1998. It's been a magnificent plant, really, until the last couple of years where it started to put up suckers, and I've been religiously cutting those off, but it just keeps putting up a lot, and it just doesn't look as healthy. Has it reached its end of its good life? Should I replace it?
Well, I would say with that plant, they like a consistently moist soil.
Yeah.
And the last 2 years have been on the dry side, so the dry weather...
I'm a religious waterer.
Okay.
It hasn't been for lack of moisture, so it's in good shape that way, but what is that suckering all about? What makes a shrub do that?
Well, some shrubs just naturally sucker. That's their pattern. For example, lilacs, the common lilac suckers quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sumacs sucker. That's just their natural habit. Other shrubs do not. So it kind of depends upon the actual plant itself. Okay. But that's a natural process. It's kind of a way for that plant to propagate itself, to spread. So it's a natural process for some plants.
Uh-huh. Well, the fact that the plant just doesn't look so great anymore, it sort of suggests to me that it's putting a lot of its energy into these suckers and less into the original shrub.
Well, you might want to go out there possibly next spring, like in April, before they leaf out, and, uh-huh. and maybe actually prune out some of the old growth, okay, uh-huh. and let some of the new growth basically take over. Okay. That's why with lilacs, we typically go out there periodically and prune out the old growth as a way to kind of rejuvenate the plant, keep it nice and young and healthy.
Do you prune a cleature like you do a lilac with taking the oldest wood back to the ground?
Right. You might want to do that. You might want to just take out some of the old growth and see how the plant responds to that.
Okay. My second question involves white light azaleas that have been in about 20 years. The last three seasons, they have been attacked after they flowered by a worm,
okay.
a Lepidopterus of some sort, that pretty much has defoliated it.
Mm-hmm.
And the greenery has definitely grown back and looks pretty good. But what that has caused, I think, is to just have a lot of foliage at the top of the plant and nothing in the bottom two-thirds.
Well, what you're probably seeing there is the larva of the azalea sawfly.
Uh-huh.
The actual caterpillar is very small, very narrow, green in color.
Yeah.
They typically appear in the spring when they're blooming or just after blooming, and they feed on the edge of the actual leaf. That's where you'll find them. And mm-hmm. I have them on my plants too, and on the smaller plants, I'll spray them with an insecticide. It'll take care of them pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
On bigger plants, I typically don't worry. But with those, they do tend to have most of their growth on the outer canopy and on the upper part of the plant. And uh-huh. so when they get to be older, sometimes they do look a little bit leggy. But that's kind of their natural growth habit. So,
okay. Is there any good pruning for those to get them to look more full?
No. You could prune them if you wanted to. I typically just let mine go.
Okay.
I have some that are about, I would guess, 9 foot tall right now. So
yeah, I think that's what mine are, too.
They can get to be fairly tall shrubs.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I need to know. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Mary. Next up, we've got Gary on the line from Sheridan. Hello, Gary.
Hello. Lots of useful information here.
That's what we specialize in. What's your question?
I bought some trees. The picture on the container showed a nice, beautiful tree. I took it home. It said sweet gum. I take it home, and I planted them, and I looked at the tag to take it off, and it said cottonwood tree. And I don't like cottonwood trees. I like the sweet gum-looking tree.
Right. Well, what kind of leaf does it have?
Oh,
I mean,
the jaggedy-looking leaf.
Okay. Well, on the sweet gum, the leaf would be more like a star shape, okay, where you have lobes like on a star.
Yes.
Okay, that's a sweet gum, okay? And a cottonwood would just be that typical heart-shaped leaf.
Yes.
And it flutters in the wind.
Oh, yes.
So there's a big difference there. So if you have a cottonwood, they're not very desirable trees. They are native to Iowa, but they grow very rapidly, and they're weak wooded, and that's their biggest Achilles heel. Because they are weak wooded, they're very prone to breakage and storms. The other thing is they'll probably produce that annoying cottony material, which gets into things, so that's not very desirable either. So if it's a cottonwood, I probably would replace it.
Three of them at $25 a piece. I'm going to uproot them today.
Okay.
Oh.
Just make sure they're a cottonwood. But if they're cottonwoods, I probably would replace them just because they're not a very good urban tree. They really aren't.
Why would they show a picture of something different than what's really in the container?
Well, I think you have a right to go back and complain to wherever
yes,
you bought them from.
You definitely do. You could go back and say, this is not. Do you have the actual label or pots yet?
Yes.
Where they have the name on the actual pot or container?
Yes.
I would go back and complain about that because a cottonwood is not a sweet gum.
Okay, very good. They're gone. I have one more question. I planted corn.
Okay.
Now the silk is coming out of the corn, and it's only 2 feet tall. I never had that happen before.
Well, you do have many, many varieties, and I will say the early maturing varieties tend to be quite short. They're not very big plants. And I think what may be occurring is you may have an early maturing variety, and on top of that, you have the hot, dry weather, which is inhibiting growth. So you're ending up with these small little small plants. If you could, I'd be watering once a week, really water them well, and that should help as far as the pollination. You might still get something.
All right, Gary, thanks a lot for your call, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist, and Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. They are here today to answer your questions, and you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Phyllis is on the line next from Denison. Hello, Phyllis.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have tomato plants that are, the leaves are totally rolling. They have grown, but they don't look healthy. And there's a few spots at the bottom of the plant where the leaf looks normal.
Phyllis, what you are actually experiencing here, I believe, is moisture stress. So are you watering your plants pretty well?
I have been watering, maybe not every week.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, with the tomatoes, watering, you have to keep up with it, you know, at least every week, as we discussed earlier, about an inch a week, because otherwise what happens, this is the initial symptom which you see in tomatoes, is that the leaf starts curling up. Now, if you don't address this issue right now, it's not going to cause a major trouble for you in terms of yield if you take control of it right now, but make sure you water it. And that way, the plant grows well. It takes up the nutrients which are needed. Two of the main ones are calcium and potassium. So if you don't water enough, you know, those nutrients will be missing. The plants will be suffering because of that as well. So it's just an initial symptom you're seeing. I certainly believe that if you start irrigating them in a constant and a uniform manner, the plants will come out of this.
Well, I hope so. Thank you. We'll give it a try. I had this trouble last year, and I did water, but...
Now, Phyllis, can I ask you a question? Did you plant the tomatoes at the same spot where you planted last year?
Not exactly, because they're in large barrels. We have a farm, and we mixed horse manure and... soil together.
Okay, well, that's good to know. You know, usually what people would do is that they would plant tomatoes after tomatoes at the same spot, or maybe the same crops in the same family, but at least you are not doing that, because otherwise that could have been another issue, is that the pathogen in the soil is building up and the plant is suffering because of that. So in this case, I would, you know, just focus a little bit more on watering them well, and I think the plant will come out of it. Do you have any deficiency symptoms on the plant, the leaves becoming pale green or showing any scorching on the margins or anything like that?
No, they are blooming.
That's good.
But they don't look healthy.
Yeah, just keep watering.
Okay, All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Phyllis. Good luck. Next up, Marcia in Des Moines. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question about rhubarb. For years, I have had a rhubarb rose behind my garage, and I've had usually four plants. 3 years ago, the whole strip just died, so I'm assuming it probably was tired of the rhubarb sitting in it. Anyway, I did replace it the next year with another three plants. Those survived last year, and then this year I lost two of them already, and there is another one out there. It was fine. It was beautiful, large, growing the stalks, and about a week ago, all of the stalks had just folded over.
Okay. Now, when you planted again the second time, did you put those back in the same location as the first plants?
Well, off a little bit footage-wise from where the others were.
Okay. I think there may be a problem with the site.
Okay.
And so what I'd probably do is look for an alternate site and plant some new plants next spring and just make sure that the site receives at least 6 hours of direct sun per day.
It has that.
Okay. And has a well-drained soil. Those two things, a sunny location and a well-drained soil. I think there may be a soil-related problem at the present site, and I would get away from that as far as I could.
All right. Now, is there a way, could I renew that soil with compost or manure or anything like that to make it so things will grow there again?
Well, you could grow other things there, but maybe rhubarb would not be a good place to put it.
All right.
So you might grow something else there. But as far as rhubarb, it may be a soil-related problem as far as like a root rot or a crown rot. That may be due to possibly to poor drainage or some other condition, but I would definitely look for an alternate site for the rhubarb and get away from that present location.
All right. What does root rot look like?
Well, if you have like a root rot, basically the plant simply collapses and dies because it doesn't have a functioning root system.
Right.
And that typically occurs, let's say, for example, in 2010, 2009, we had very, very wet years, and if that soil stayed too wet, possibly, then a root rot could begin to affect the root system and cause that plant to eventually die. So it could be a soil-related problem.
When you when you pull the plant out of the soil, if you look at the root, if you see most of them decaying and brown in color, you don't see any white new growth of root there, which means, you know, the root is eventually going to die. So,
all right. All right. Well, thank you so much for your information.
Thanks a lot for your call, Marcia.
You are welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Next up, Elwood is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Elwood.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
I wonder how you get rid of cicada wasps.
Well, you actually don't have to. They're actually not that much of a threat. They are big, and they look quite threatening. But actually, they typically don't bother you unless you bother them. And so the key there is to kind of ignore them. Only the female can sting. The male cannot. And so for the most part, they're typically all bark and no bite for the most part. So if you ignore them, typically you'll be fine. Now, if you want to control them, you can. And probably the best way to do that is to go out late in the evening when it's getting dark almost. And if you have the insecticide 7, you want the dust form, and you want to kind of poof the 7 dust down the opening. And so the next day, when they get active again, and they start going in and out of that hole, they'll brush against the 7 dust, and that will probably kill them. Basically, what they're doing is they're digging this really deep hole, and then they're taking... they're going out and getting a cicada. They paralyze that cicada. They lay an egg in the bottom of the hole, and then they put the cicada at the bottom of the hole so when the egg hatches, it has food. So that's what they're actually up to.
All right. That was an excellent Donald Lewis impression, too.
Thank you,
Richard. Well done. So these are really impressive looking wasps.
Oh, they are.
So people are going to see a lot of them
yes.
in the next few weeks.
They're quite active right now, and they are big, and they look really, really threatening when they fly around. But for the most part, they don't bother you much.
Right,
so
and I think
that's the key.
I think that Donald last year said that in 30-some-odd years of talking about them, he'd only met one guy who'd been stung, and that man picked it up and held it in his hand.
Right, which was kind of foolish.
Right. So I'm sorry, Donald, if I didn't tell that story right, but these are not dangerous. Elwood, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Ron in Garden Grove. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I was wondering what some of the benefits of the high tunnel was other than extending the growing season.
Excellent question, Ron. There are multiple benefits of using high tunnel. The number one, as you mentioned, is extending the season. The other one is that you can manage your crop underneath those high tunnels in a better way. So let's say if it rains, you know, hard outside, what will happen is that there'll be a lot of splash of soil on your plant, you know.
Yeah.
So there'll be more diseases spreading. With a high tunnel, you kind of eliminate that issue completely. So that's one advantage.
Yeah.
You can manage the irrigation well. You can have a drip irrigation system because of which you irrigate when the plants need it, not just indiscriminately watering the plants. The fruit quality is better because sometime when your fruit is about to ripen or it's close to harvest, if there is a hard rain, the plant can take in a lot of water and you can see some cracks appearing on the fruit. So the fruits in that case will lose the market value. So you don't want that to happen. So high tunnels help in that case as well.
Do you have a trouble with bugs in them much?
There has been a mixed response and research, you know, looking at if there is more pest inside the high tunnel or outside. It's still inconclusive. Usually, high tunnels kind of are on the lower end of disease pressure. If you find them, disease or insect, you need to make sure you control them immediately because it can spread very quickly. The temperature are conducive for the pest to grow. It's nice and warm. So at this point, you know, there's no clear answer out there.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Judy on the line from Lamoni. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm calling about a flowering pear tree. And it, the last two summers, the leaves on it have turned black. It's probably 25 or 30 years old.
Okay. Now, when you say black, is it just small areas on the tree or the entire tree or exactly?
The entire tree, but not all of the leaves, you know, okay. Probably about a third of them.
And is it the tips of the branches?
No. Well, it's mostly the leaves.
Okay. Well, one thing comes to mind is fire blight, which is a bacterial disease, and it typically attacks the new growth. And so the leaves on the affected shoot will turn dark brown to black.
Yes.
Looks like it's been burnt.
Yes.
And the other thing is the stem will get kind of limp, and so the very top of it will kind of droop over. So you have this cane-shaped shoot that comes up and then kind of droops over. So that's kind of classic symptoms of fire blight. Fire blight is hard to control. The best way to control that, it's not a fungus, so you can't use a fungicide. You would typically have to prune out the affected areas and hope in doing so that you eliminate the actual fire blight. What you may want to do is to take some digital photographs of your tree, of your pear tree, some
yes.
nice, sharp photographs, and send those to the Plant Diagnostic Clinic here at Iowa State. And
okay.
the address for that, as far as the email address, is P as in plant, I as in insect, D as in disease, C as in clinic, at iastate.edu, okay, and see if they can diagnose that based on the photographs and go from there.
Okay. Okay, what was the last of that again? Iowa State, and then what was the last?
It's IASTATE dot.
Okay, Iowa State. Okay.
EDU at the end.
Okay, EDU.
Most educational sites have that as their end on their address.
Okay, instead of a zip code, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay. Thanks a lot for your call, Judy. Next up, Kathy's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm looking for a recommendation for a shade tree for the northeast side of my house. I've got like a 25 by 35 foot corner of the house that, and I've got a big lot. It's a pie-shaped lot. It's a fan-shaped lot. And so I've got a lot of space, and I need some shade over there. And I was wondering if you had any recommendations on something that would grow quickly, of course, but yet be strong.
But it would be to the northeast of the house?
Correct.
Okay. Now, that's not going to provide much in the way of shade to the house. The best shading comes from trees on the southwest or west side of the house, also on the east side of the house. So on the northeast, you're not going to get much shading as far as from the tree. How close would the tree be to the house?
Well, I mean, it's a big lot. It could be probably, it's 2/3 of an acre. But see, the northeast side of the house has yews against the house. I took out some blue spruce and put in a nice, you know, 6 large arborvitae, and it's got a nice pin oak back there.
Okay.
The south side of the house has a nice sugar maple, and it's just this northwest corner that is just glaring hot, and there's no protection in the winter.
Okay. I would consider a linden. Okay.
Japanese beetle?
I know, but I would possibly consider that just to have some genetic diversity. I would consider maybe another oak, but possibly a red oak. I would consider maybe another maple.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly one of the silver maple, red maple hybrids. And I might try something a little bit different. I might try, for example, a bald cypress, which is, they're nice looking plants. They're actually conifers, but they shed their foliage in the fall of the year like most other trees. But they have a very nice, I think, attractive look to them, kind of a soft, medium green color. Nice trees, actually. So you might want to consider that, just to have some diversity in the landscape.
Okay, so you said a red oak. What about a swamp white oak?
A swamp white oak would be, I think, okay. Now, one thing with the swamp white oak, they do require an acid soil where the pH is below 7. And if you have a pH above 7, then that tree may be quite chlorotic like the pin oak would be. So if the pH is a little bit high, I would say a red oak would be a better choice.
Okay. And then in terms of next to the house, right now it's all hostas. It's 25 foot by 35 foot. It's all hostas. And there used to be pear trees on the west side that we've since taken out. And so the hostas get burned. And I was wondering about putting something a little closer to the house for insulation in the winter, like yews, or I've seen people put arborvitae close to the house.
Let's let Richard respond quickly. What do you think, Richard?
Possibly some yews. They do well in sun or shade. Arborvitae, if you get one that maybe isn't too big.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Kathy. And Richard Giron, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ajay Nair, thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Charity.
Iowa State University Extension. We'll be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Alyssa Weiss in Ames today. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on the show, how the Civil War advanced medicine. This is Talk of Iowa.